is case number 53675, Frazier versus State. Mr. Carnell on behalf of the appellant and Mr. Reynolds on behalf of the state of Nevada.
Mr. Carnell, before you get started, I was happy to see you two shake hands. I wish all attorneys would do that before our argument, maybe afterwards too. It'd be,
we've had a collegial relation throughout this nice case, although it's the first case we've had with one another. And I will say that he wrote a very fine brief. Okay, as I hope he would say about me.
Well, you always do as well. And I just wanted to congratulate Mr. Reynolds. His wife works for the Supreme Court and just had a baby yesterday, so we haven't yet seen that. I just wanted to congratulate you and Katie on that. Thank you.
Mr. Carnell, do you want to reserve time on us?
If I don't run out of time on my opening remarks, yes. Because I have plenty to say.
Leave it to your discretion.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
If it pleases the court, counsel, my name is Richard Cornell. I represent the appellant in this case, Ryan Frazier. This case involves some troubling, indeed disturbing, indeed profound legal issues, in my opinion. First and foremost, can a trial prosecutor testify before a trial jury in order to impeach his victim's in-court cross-examined testimony? Should Tomlin v. State be distinguished or perhaps even overruled or overruled in part? Secondly, what actually is the standard of review for adjudicating competency of a child witness? I submit, whatever it is, it's certainly not whether the child has the ability to recall recent events. I submit that's not the standard. Based on the proper standard, did this child's testimony meet that standard? Thirdly, if a child witness is physically present but cannot remember the prior statements to a detective, such that the defendant cannot cross-examine her on those statements and she can't otherwise read or write, does that make her unavailable within the meaning of Crawford v. Washington as to those statements to the detective? Fourthly, can a child's out-of-court statements be admitted per Idaho v. Wright if they do not fit into any well-grounded exception to the hearsay rule other than 51385, are inconsistent, are rejected by the jury, and the child doesn't remember making them? And fifthly, how do we define the term motive and the terms at issue with per Ledbetter v. State in the light of Braunstein, Richmond, Taylor, and like cases? That is to say, in determining motive in a sexual abuse case, what separates propensity evidence from motive evidence? Let me talk about the first issue. It's our position. Our position is straightforward. It simply cannot be anything but error to allow the trial prosecutor to testify as a fact witness before a trial jury. We submit that as a liminal matter. It simply cannot be permitted. The question is it harmless? And our position there is, in this case, it simply cannot be harmless here when the trial prosecutor uses the witness stand to criticize defense counsel's method of cross-examination when that bolsters his detective's version of the child's out-of-court statement. We have cited to you a number of cases throughout the country in our briefs, notably Powers v. State from Texas, United States v. Edwards from the Ninth Circuit, People v. Blue from Illinois, and United States v. Johnston from the Seventh Circuit. And every court that I can tell since Tomlin that really has rolled up its sleeves and dealt in this issue has concluded allowing the trial prosecutor to testify before the trial jury as a fact witness is error because it's an improper form of prosecutorial vouching, and that's forbidden by the Sixth Amendment. The issue is it harmless? And in this case, that issue begs some hard questions. As I said, Mr. Reynolds wrote a very fine brief, but the hard questions that I have aren't really answered, and they are these. First off, why didn't Lyon County have an investigator present at all interviews between Mr. Auer and E.G.? I think I know the answer, which is, well, that can happen in Washoe County and Clark County, where they have the budget to have DA investigators. We're a small county. We don't have that kind of money in the budget. True, but we've got investigators in Lyon County. Why we have Detective Rye in Lyon County, we know. Why is it that we don't have some third party present who can testify when a child goes south? Why do we have to have the prosecutor do that? Go south in the opinion of the district attorney, I should say. Secondly, If in this case, when this issue arose during trial, over vigorous objection by Mr. Schlegelmilch, if the issue was whether Mr. Auer and E.G. had lunch at Deeney's, why not call the waitress at Deeney's? I asked that question in the motion for new trial that I wrote. It's never been answered. I refuse to accept an answer that the waitress at Deeney's does not know or does not recognize Robert Auer, the elected district attorney of Lyon County. I simply cannot accept such an answer. It begs the question, why do we have to have the district attorney testify on that issue? Why not the waitress? The third question is that I have that hasn't been answered is this. If leading questions are permitted on cross-examination of all witnesses in Nevada and of child witnesses even on direct per Barkas versus State, how do we fault Mr. Schlegelmilch for his cross-examination of E.G.? How does his proper cross-examination of E.G. open any door for a Sixth Amendment violation? The U.S. Supreme Court made very clear in Young versus United States that we have to use the open door very, very carefully, the open door policy very, very carefully, because after all, it isn't defense counsel has Sixth Amendment right to fair trial, it's a defendant. So it begs the question, why not that? How did he open the door consistently with Young? Fourthly, if Tomlin is still good law, why then was there no limiting instruction to the jury in this case, and why was there no instruction to the lawyers not to comment on the Mr. Auer's testimony?
Was it requested by the defense?
It was not. I submit to you that in this situation, the duty is going to fall on the judge sua sponte to give it, since it was the judge who allowed Mr. Auer to testify. In fact, it was the judge who suggested that Mr. Auer testify. And when you read Tomlin, I don't sense that this court in 1965 felt real easy about allowing a prosecutor to testify as a fact witness, but they allowed for the limiting instructions that were given as, I would say, curing the error. The Supreme Court in 1965 didn't use those words, but that's, as I read Tomlin, what this court meant. And fifthly, how do you justify Mr. Auer testifying at all for the first time at trial under NRPC 3.7? Counsel is correct. Supreme Court Rule 185 was not mentioned in Tomlin. Nevertheless, it was in effect at the time of Tomlin, and what the trial court did in Tomlin was consistent with Rule 185. As I read Rule 3.7, when this issue comes up at trial, the trial lawyers don't testify at all. That's why we have depositions in civil cases. That's why we have interviews with investigators in criminal cases, so that this doesn't happen.
Well, Mr. Kerner, I understand all these arguments, and again, it was well briefed from both sides. My concern is this is a harmless issue. Assuming it was wrong, we have a situation where Mr. Auer testified. He ceased his involvement in the case at that time after his testimony, and then the Lyon County DA's office took it from there. And he wasn't commenting on his own credibility to the jury or things like that could be very problematic. But tell me why it wasn't harmless in light of all the other evidence in the case.
Very, very elementary. Because had he just said, I didn't have lunch with E.G., I would agree with that position that's not harmless. What he did in cross-examination was criticize Mr. Schlegelmilch's method of cross-examination and getting accurate information out of the witness. What that left the jury with was Schlegelmilch doesn't know how to examine a child. Who does Detective Rye? What was the child's version to Detective Rye? It was digital penetration. What did the jury convict my client of? Digital penetration. That, I find, is to be the real problem in this case. And as I say, to add to fuel to the fire, the criticism of Mr. Schlegelmilch's method of cross-examination is wrong as a matter of law. He can ask, a detective shouldn't ask leading questions in the psychological sense of a child to get information. A lawyer at trial can ask leading questions on cross-examination. They're two different matters. That's my position. Let me talk about the competency of the witness issue, if I may. I submit to you that in the final analysis, Schuff, S-H-U-F-F, from 1970, is still the standard. A child witness must relate his impressions with knowledge of the difference between truth and falsehood and in light of that knowledge. Put another way, the child has to understand the oath that he's just taken and what it means. An abuse, counsel is correct. This issue is adjudicated on abuse of discretion, but certainly it's an abuse of discretion to use the wrong standard in determining a child is competent. The fact that a child can recall recent events, as Judge Huff stated twice, is not the same thing as understanding the meaning of the oath. I submit to you that the case that is most on point is the case I cited, page 7 of the reply brief, the Griffin case from Florida, because that trial judge used essentially that same standard, and that trial judge was reversed. And on this record, when we look at what the judge should have ruled, given the wrong standard, and whether this is harmless error, the disturbing thing that I see in this case is as follows. First off, at the preliminary hearing, EG testified that nothing happened. To Ms. Gibbs, the grandmother, and to Ms. Goodman, the babysitter, we have digital intercourse, but we also have vaginal intercourse. The SARTS examination refutes vaginal intercourse. Detective Rye, we have digital penetration. The SARTS exam cannot either confirm or deny that. To Nurse Cornell, no relation to me, by the way, we have anal penetration with a stick. The SARTS examination refutes that. To the jury, we have cunnilingus. Then we have digital penetration, and then nothing happened, all within a matter of seconds. And my first liminal question is, how do we distinguish this from Felix? Then the second problem I have in adjudicating competency of the witness is, yes, the state and the trial court can cherry-pick certain items that make EG look like she might be competent, but we have to look at the whole record. We hear, and when we look at the whole record, we have a child who testifies that Peter Pan is real. We have a child who cannot identify Mr. Frazier at the competency hearing, and then 2 days later immediately identifies in open court before the jury. We have a child who in the competency hearing believes she's on an airplane. We have a child, a trial doesn't know her last name. We have a child who also says the district attorney told her what to testify to, and we all agree that didn't happen. We have a child, clearly, who is not acting out sexually, per everybody's testimony. And we have a child who smiles when she sees Ryan. We have a child who cannot describe digital penetration to Detective Rye, the version that the jury agreed with, but says, Ryan hurt my pee-pee and is going to jail, to Detective Rye. Detective Rye admitted on cross-examination that someone apparently told EG what to tell her. And my question is, how is that not coaching? It's not coaching by the district attorney, I'm not saying that, but Felix doesn't and Evans don't require that. This sounds like coached testimony. And most critically, we have a child who testifies that she cannot remember making a statement to the police, meaning to Detective Rye. Now, there's no question that EG's statement to Detective Rye is testimonial hearsay per Flores. The question is, she unavailable? The state says, well, of course she's available. She was there physically, and this case is just like Pentano. I submit to you this case isn't like Pentano at all. Unlike Pentano, we have a child who 2 times has denied anything happened under oath. That's not the facts of Pentano. We have a child who can't read. That apparently is not the facts of Pentano. We have a child who doesn't remember making the statement to the police. And you'll see that at Appellant's Appendix Volume 4, page 836. I don't see that fact in Pentano. Accordingly, what we have is a child who can't be cross-examined regarding a statement, can't really be shown the statement. She's unavailable per that statement I sent you, and I think the case most on point here is the Rorich case that I cited in the reply brief at pages 13 and 14, although the cases I cited in the brief, opening brief at pages 27 through 29 are also apposite. So when you have a child who cannot remember the offense at all at time of the prelim and at time of the cross-examination at trial and can't remember making the statement, I submit that child is incompetent for Crawford purposes vis-a-vis that statement. That statement should not come in. That statement is critical.
I'm so sorry to interrupt, but I really do want to hear you comment on the prior bad acts in this case.
Yes, thank you. I'll skip over the Idaho versus Wright issue, and I do want to talk about that. Thank you, because that is a profound issue. Ledbetter, this court made very clear in Ledbetter, it was not overruling Braunstein, nor was it reinstating Finley and McMichael. Finley and McMichael remain overruled. I submit to you that in applying Ledbetter, the court must ask two basic questions. Is motive really at issue? If so, is the state's evidence more than propensity evidence? Does it meet the third test of Tinch, really? And the answer of, well, motive is always at issue, I know the court said that, but it said that in the context of Ledbetter, where motive was at issue. When the theory of the case, which was here, and the theory of case instructions so stated, is that nothing happened, how is motive at issue? Nothing happened, this child made it up. Not somebody else did it. This child made it up, this child is testifying to fantasy. That's the defense position. How is motive at issue there? But more importantly, and the court doesn't necessarily have to answer that question, and talk about that versus Honkanen and Taylor and the like. More importantly, what do we have here? We have one touching of EG, one touching of Samantha, two strangers to each other, one time touching in each case, 6 years apart or so, different touches, different circumstances. How is that not propensity evidence? I submit it is propensity evidence, and it's holy writ, we don't allow propensity evidence in under 48045. I think the cases that are most on point here are the ones I've cited from out-of-state jurisdictions at pages 23 through 23 of the reply brief, State versus Cox from Utah, State versus Winter from Vermont, and State versus Saltarelli from Washington. But legally, I think this case falls right into the pigeonhole of Richmond. Motive. Does the Samantha case explain why Ryan Frazier touched EG inappropriately? And if the fact of the matter is that these touches happened 6 years apart, allegedly, and these two were strangers, the answer has to be no. I'm out of time, I guess. But
let me ask you this, Mr. Cornell, on Ledbetter. I think I was the only one on the court who was part of that decision. I believe it was before Justice Cherry and Seda joined the court. Didn't you view Ledbetter as codifying all this series of cases, Richmond, Braunstein, the others, to try and say, okay, we got this mess out here of all these different cases making different holdings, and Ledbetter tried to codify the issue of motivation as to when it's permitted, that evidence? Well, what is it? And I consider you an appellate expert. I'd be interested in your take on
respectfully,
that.
Respectfully, I know you were part of the decision on Ledbetter. Justice Maupin may have written that decision. I'm not sure.
He was the author, right?
He was the
author. I think it was a collective effort.
But what I see in Ledbetter is quite opposite. I see Ledbetter saying this is very fact-specific.
Okay.
And in Ledbetter, the defense acknowledged penetration, but claimed it was from a source other than Ledbetter. In Ledbetter, the uncharged misconduct happened contemporaneously and over like a 10-year period of time. And the victims, the uncharged and charged victims, were in the same family. I believe they were stepchildren of Ledbetter. And as I read Ledbetter, I think those are the facts that drive the decision. I'm not here to say Ledbetter is incorrectly decided. I do believe Tomlin was, to the extent that Tomlin may be read to say a trial prosecutor may properly testify before a jury as a fact witness. But I don't think Ledbetter is wrongly decided, but I think Ledbetter is specific to those facts, and it doesn't address the case where the charged and uncharged victim are strangers, and it doesn't address the facts where they happen as far apart as this case. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cornell, I'm going to give you 2 minutes in rebuttal, and Mr.
Thank
Reynolds, I'm going to give you 17 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And Mr. Reynolds, while you're approaching, maybe you could clarify us. The three of us meet before the oral arguments to kind of go over the cases and all oral arguments and prepare our questions and all. But could you clarify for us the age of the victim in this case at the time the incident allegedly occurred versus the time she testified at trial, and also the age of the other bad act, Ms. Morrison, and how old she was in relationship to the age of Mr. Frazier at the time that act allegedly occurred.
Certainly, Justice Gibbons, good morning. May it please the court. I'm Joseph Reynolds. I'm a deputy district attorney for Lyon County, and I'm here on behalf of the people of Lyon County and the state of Nevada. To answer your question, Justice Gibbons, the victim in this case was 4 years old when the crime occurred. She was 6 years old when she testified trial. Ms. Morrison testified when I believe she was 19 years old at trial, and she was around 11 or 12 years old when she was assaulted by the defendant.
And how old was Mr. Frazier when Ms. Morrison was age 11 or 12?
I can't recall specifically off the top of my head.
You have a ball, but maybe Mr. Cornell could help us. 19. The allegation was a 19-year-old with an 11 or 12-year-old then like that. Okay.
I hope that answers the court's question.
Thank you.
This court should affirm the defendant's conviction for sexually assaulting a child under the age of 14 years old. This court should also affirm the district court's decision to deny his post-verdict motion for acquittal and his post-verdict motion for a new trial. I plan to address three issues before the court. Those were the three issues raised by Mr. Cornell. The remaining issues, I believe, are adequately addressed by the state in our answering brief. The first issue with respect to whether it was proper for the district attorney, Bob Auer, to testify under the unique facts of this case, it certainly was. It certainly was proper under Nevada law, and it was also proper under fundamental fairness. The appellant asked this court to either disregard or overrule or abrogate Tomlin v. State. That is a Nevada case that has remained good law for 45 years. It came from this court in this jurisdiction. It's factually on point.
I'd like to hear you show that it's factually on point, that Tomlin is factually on point with the instant case.
Certainly, Justice Cherry. In Tomlin, we had a Washoe County deputy, a district attorney, who was prosecuting a criminal matter, who took the stand unexpectedly, unforeseeably during trial to testify as a witness to rebut another witness's testimony. And even the facts in Tomlin, I think, are more concerning than what happened here, because unlike the facts here in Tomlin, the deputy district attorney in that case kept prosecuting the case. Here, District Attorney Auer, after he testified, promptly recused himself, and our chief deputy of our office, Mark Kruger, prosecuted the remainder of the case. What this court recognized in Tomlin are three factors as to whether or not it is proper for a prosecutor to testify during a trial. The first one is unforeseeability. That factor is clearly met in this case. The district attorney had no intention whatsoever of ever testifying at trial. It was an issue that spontaneously arose and was raised by the defense counsel in this case. The second is whether extraordinary unforeseen circumstances are warranted. Here we're in the middle of a jury trial. The district attorney is accused of a crime, witness tampering, by defense counsel. Though Mr. Cornell argues that somehow an unknown waitress at lunch should have been called to testify, the accusation was personal. The accusation was that the district attorney himself, out of his own mouth, told the six-year-old girl what to say on the stand. He was the only person who could rebut those accusations. Nobody else could. And that, during Tomlin, is prompt recusal, which certainly happened in this case. Tomlin is consistent with rulings from a majority, or at least a number, of other state jurisdictions, and is also consistent with federal authority. Nobody ever likes the idea of an attorney having to testify during a trial. But the courts have consistently recognized sometimes it's warranted, sometimes it's appropriate, and it was so in this case. Appellant makes some arguments that somehow Tomlin has been implicitly overruled because of a change in ethical standards adopted by this court. Addressing that argument, first of all, it's important to note that former Supreme Court Rule 185 was not mentioned or linked to Tomlin in any way. This court, in 1986, adopted the model ABA rules wholeheartedly, took our old rules of professional conduct and adopted the ABA rules. What we have today is NRCP 3.7, which appellant cites and contends that that prohibited the district attorney from testifying. I direct this court to look at the express language of NRCP 3.7. It clearly uses the words is likely. It's an anticipatory rule. It's a rule that when a lawyer can foresee the need or possibility that he may be called as a witness, he should not prosecute the case. That's wholly different than what happened in this case. The rule of professional conduct is silent as to what happened here, because what happened here was wholly unforeseeable. So to say that an ethical rule somehow overrules or trumps an evidentiary rule, which was what Tomlin set forth, when the evidence can properly be admitted, I think is a misguided. What is also important to note is that Tomlin embraces a flexible, common sense approach. To adopt appellant's argument that somehow anytime a prosecutor takes the stand after being accused of witness tampering to rebut those allegations, appellant would have this court adopt a per se rule that is expressly prohibited. That would essentially bootstrap the state in not ever being able to respond to those, giving an unfair disadvantage when those accusations are lodged. Because when there was only three remedies in this case when it happened. Say nothing. District court could declare a mistrial. Or what happened here is have the district attorney testify.
And what was his testimony? Mr. Cornell seemed to indicate he went a little bit too far when he testified, that he attacked the defense counsel.
Your Honor, probably the most important fact in this appeal is that the defense counsel opened the door to this entire issue twice. The first time he did, when he, out of nowhere, asked the six-year-old victim whether she had lunch with the district attorney. Now, it's important to also recognize that this cross-examination occurred after Lyon County Sheriff's Sergeant Sherry Rye, who is an expert in examining child sexual assault victims. She testified that it is improper to ask these young victims leading questions. It is improper to suggest answers in questioning them. Now, after hearing the testimony of Sergeant Rye, defense counsel got up and started asking the six-year-old victim leading suggestive questions, which culminated in eliciting a response, a yes or no type response, that she did go to lunch with the district attorney and that he did tell her what to say. He opened the door to therefore Mr. Auer having to testify. It's a bedrock principle of this court that when whether it's the state or defense, when as a matter of strategy, you pursue a case theory, you can't therefore later complain on appeal that error occurred. But that's exactly what the appellant is doing. They opened the door to the matter. They compelled the testimony of the district attorney. And now they want to claim on appeal that this was reversible error. The second instance when they opened the door, if this court would note, is during defense counsel's cross-examination of the district attorney, he started asking about his examination of the victim. Meaning, make sure I'm clear here, the defense counsel began to ask district attorney about the defense counsel's method of cross-examining the six-year-old girl. He again opened the door twice. The district attorney, in all fairness, is allowed to therefore respond to that and explain his answers. Tomlin should not be overruled. It should not be abrogated. It's uncommon, but not unprecedented. The law was followed here. We had unforeseeability, extraordinary circumstances, prompt withdrawal.
What about the competency of the victim's testimony?
Unlike appellant, I urge this court to follow its own law. The standard of review regarding a child competency is set forth in Kirshner. It's also discussed in Evans v. State. This court shouldn't look to Florida law on this issue. It should look to Nevada law. A competency hearing was held prior to trial, like it was supposed to, by the district court. And the district court found that the six-year-old was competent to testify. In its post-verdict motion, after having heard everything that transpired, the district court again found that the child victim was competent to testify. The standard of review for those decisions is whether the district court committed a clear abuse of discretion. It did not. Because a six-year-old can get tripped up on a leading cross-examination does not mean she's incompetent. As this court are all former district court judges who've seen trials, even the most experienced adults who've testified can get tripped up on a cross-examination. When the victim testified at trial, she knew her age, she knew the names of her mother, her grandmother, she knew she used to live in Urington, she knew she lives in Colorado, she knew she was in kindergarten, she knew her brother, she identified the defendant as Ryan. She correctly identified the female body parts of a diagram. She accurately described colors and objects. And because she believed in Peter Pan does not mean she's incompetent. I submit to this court every six-year-old, hopefully in this state, believes in Peter Pan, in Santa Claus, in the Easter Bunny.
Mr. Reynolds, I have a question that goes directly to what I believe is the core of a child's competency to testify, and that is that somehow the trial judge must sit and question the child in a manner that elicits whether or not the child knows that telling the truth is of the utmost importance. And we have to do that in a way that a four-year-old or a six-year-old or an eight-year-old will understand, but so that we can know that the child understands the difference between, is this a lie? If I tell you that your suit coat is yellow, is that the truth or is that a lie? I mean, those are the type of questions that I believe are supposed to be asked in order to test the competency of a child witness. Were any of those type of questions asked in this instance?
Yes, Justice Seda. The district court specifically examined the six-year-old himself during the pretrial competency.
But not with matters of currency, meaning what is your name, how old are you, who is your brother, in terms of does the child understand the difference between right and wrong and how important it is that what the child talks about in court on that particular day is in fact the truth.
Yes, the district court was satisfied that the child in this case understood the difference between a truth and a lie, did understand the difference between right and wrong, and was satisfied prior to trial and was satisfied after trial. And what's important to remember is the district court saw everything that happened. So did the jury. This court traditionally gives deference to the district court's decisions regarding competency determinations because they are in the best position to assess what happened. They saw the six-year-old little girl get on the stand with her teddy bear and testify in this case. The district court saw the defense attorney go up and ask her leading questions. He saw everything that transpired, and so did the jury. Excuse me, I have a cold, and I'm...
Okay.
I need a quick drink. I apologize. Those happened in this case. Lyon County Sheriff's Detective Sergeant Rye also testified, who's an expert in these, that she found the 6-year-old at or above grade level for her age. Her babysitter, Kara Goodman, testified that the 6-year-old was smart and sharp. What has happened here is the defense has taken a snippet of a leading cross-examination that tripped up a 6-year-old in full court after she had already told her story, which she was done, tripped her up, and now is using this as a basis to say she was incompetent. If anything, it goes to credibility, which is the province of the jury to decide. It doesn't go to her competency. She was competent. And again, because she believed in Peter Pan, I think every 6-year-old does or should.
You want to comment on the Prior Bad Act?
Yes, Your Honor. What this court did in Ledbetter v. State was reconcile Richmond. We look at Richmond. Three justices of this court reversed in Richmond. Justice Maupin was in the middle. He agreed with the decision to reverse in Richmond, but did so for a different reason. Three justices were in the dissent. Justice Maupin authored Ledbetter, and what this court agreed with was that when deciding the admissibility of these acts, we have to apply the three-tinch factor test, whether it's relevant, whether it's clear and convincing, and where the probative value is not substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. This court said in Ledbetter, what motivates someone to commit these crimes is always relevant. Here we had Samantha Morrison testify that when she was 11 or 12 years old, the defendant stuck his finger forcibly into her vagina. That's what the jury heard, and that's what he was also charged with doing to the 6-year-old little girl in this case. The crimes are very similar. Digital penetration against a younger female by this defendant. It shows that he was motivated and attracted to do this. It was relevant. And most importantly, the district court held a Petrocelli hearing like it was required to do, gave limiting instructions like it was required to do. The law was followed. And I submit to the court that that's not an issue. It was proper and something for the jury to hear. And finally,
go ahead, because I've got one more question. I'll see if the panel has some more questions.
Another essential fact for this court to know with respect to whether harmless error occurred. The state submits that no error occurred. But an indisputable fact is the jury only convicted the defendant of one of two charged counts. What that tells this court is that any error by the district attorney in testifying was harmless. Our office asked for conviction of two counts. If they were so persuaded by the district attorney's testimony, they would have convicted of both. Instead, they convicted of one after hearing everything.
Well, that was the question I was going to ask. It's amazing that we're on the same wavelength. But doesn't that show that maybe the evidence of the prior bad act was a propensity to this jury because they did not convict of the penetration in the vagina, rather just the penetration, the digital penetration?
Well, no, Your Honor. What it does show is that the jury, when they considered all the evidence of the testimony of Kira Goodman of when the victim spontaneously, which distinguishes this case from Felix, spontaneously told her babysitter, without ever mentioning it before, that Ryan, the defendant, hurt her pee-pee, and it hurts when she goes to the bathroom. She testified to that to Lyon County Sheriff Sergeant Rye. She testified to that to her grandmother, Yolanda Gibbs. She testified to that during trial. There was no prejudice by Ms. Morrison's testimony in the jury hearing that. Tinch was followed. Ledbetter was followed. The law was applied. It was fairly applied. It was relevant for the district court to hear that. And I ask that this court affirm the defendant's conviction.
Let me just say, did you have any other questions, Justice Gibbons? Thank you, Mr. Reynolds.
Thank you.
Mr. Cornell, you have a couple minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And I appreciate the extra time and the court's keen inquiries. This is a case that deserves it.
The key to Tomlin, as I read Tomlin, are the limiting instructions, not just to the jury, but to the lawyers. You know, Tomlin makes pretty clear what's supposed to happen in that case. The lawyers aren't supposed to discuss the prosecutor's testimony to the jury. That didn't happen in this case. The lawyers did. Mr. Schlegelmel directly, Mr. Kruger indirectly, as I pointed out in the briefs. And as far as shouldn't the defense have asked for the limiting instruction? Well, I go back to what this court decided in 2005 in Carter. Sometimes there are instructions, such as in Carter, the theory of the case instruction, that are so central to the Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial that the duty falls on the judge sua sponte to give them. And I submit to you that this is one of those situations because it's so alarming to have the litigators testify. I remember the first appeal I handled in 1980. It was Justice Thompson's last argument. You'll see it in Kaiser versus State, 96 Nevada. It was a case where I was a deputy district attorney, and what happened was the prosecutor called the defense lawyer in rebuttal to blow up the defendant's alibi. And as a young prosecutor, it wasn't a pleasant experience for my first argument, shall I say. But you can see why. This is the kind of thing that doesn't happen. It's not supposed to happen. We're not supposed to have the lawyers testify before the jury. It's not supposed to be. Different reasons for the defense lawyer versus the prosecutor, but they all go back to the Sixth Amendment. Regarding competency, I agree with Mr. Reynolds. The sine qua non of competency is not prior inconsistent statements. A competent witness can get confused on whether this happened in a blue car or a red car, or whether it happened at 3 in the afternoon or 2 in the afternoon. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about vastly wildly different stories on what happened on the one and one, only one occasion. And to answer Justice Sata's question, what the record reveals is in the competency hearing, the child knows the difference between a truth and a lie, but what happens if you lie? You go to timeout with grandma. That's what the child said. Well, the child's given an inculpatory version to grandma. If the child's already testified to an exculpatory version, what does that tell us? And then Judge Huff says, well, are you going to tell the truth today? The child says yes. He says, okay, he's competent. Fine for today. What about tomorrow when you're in front of the jury? That's what we're talking about. Is it an adequate canvas? I would submit to you no. And finally, on the 48045 issue, ultimately, remember, please, motive has to explain why the defendant did what? Committed the act. Which act? The charged act. And I would add to that, any manner other than propensity. I still have yet to hear how a 6 or 7 or 8 year old prior act explains why this defendant committed this act in a manner other than having the propensity to do so. Thank you very much for your attention.
Well, thank you to both Mr. Cornell and Mr. Reynolds for your argument in this matter. It's very interesting. And this case will stand submitted. And this panel will be in recess until we meet in Fallon, Nevada tomorrow at Churchill.